Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor LeCain. We all want to be secure, but does more spending on the military make us more secure? How much do we spend on the military anyway? And how much is enough? Here to talk with us about all this and more is Dr. Douglas Hall, Executive Director of the National Priorities Project, which helps people understand the federal budget so we can see and influence how our tax dollars are spent. Doug has extensive experience in research and analysis that informs policies to improve the well-being of all Americans. He served as director of the Economic Analysis and Research Network at the Economic Policy Institute for 5 years. During Doug's tenure at EPI, EARN grew to a network of 61 primarily state-based organizations representing 44 states. Doug's work emphasizes the impact of federal spending at the state and local levels. Douglas Hall, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you so much for having me on.
So I'm excited to talk to you on the air. I loved meeting you at the Congressional Progressive Caucus Strategy meeting in Philadelphia. And I know you're doing great work and have for years, so I'm eager for you to share what you know with our listeners. Let's start with the budget now that President Obama recently proposed a budget that would put a lot of money into the military. Can you tell us what is our current military budget and how much is the president proposing we spend? Is he going up or down?
Well, it's a good question. So he's actually going up quite significantly. We're looking actually at a budget proposal of about $612 billion on national defense. And that represents an increase of about 4.5% over the 2015 budget. So we're definitely in a growth phase there. And I think it's really important to keep that in context. I mean, we're talking about, you know, a piece of the budget that was already so huge that, you know, it dwarfs everything else, you know, tenfold.
So just so I'm hearing this right, you're talking, he's proposing that we're going to spend $612 billion, which is up 4%?
That's right, 4.5%.
4.5%. How can he do that? Given the sequester, you know, that big agreement we had that got the government moving again after the Republicans threatened to shut it down.
Right.
They said, okay, we'll agree to cut the military and cut everything else equally. And they said this is so heinous that we'll obviously pass something to replace it. And, of course, they could never agree on anything to replace it. So that sequester is what's in place. I thought we're supposed to be cutting military and domestic spending equally. What's going on?
Well, that's right. And certainly the president's budget proposal, blows through that sequester cap pretty significantly. And actually pretty much equally on both the defense side and the non-defense side.
All right. So maybe he's hoping to get Republican votes because he's upping the money for the domestic spending to fix our roads and bridges.
Well, I think that's probably what, the thinking there is. It feels a little bit to me like, the president's, if his opening salvo is to, give away the defense piece of that puzzle already, I'm not certain that's necessarily the best negotiating, place to start. But, the bottom line is, at the end of the day, you're looking at a budget that sets aside the sequester, which, regardless of what your thoughts are on which direction our spending cuts should be going, the sequestration process was so completely arbitrary that, mm-hmm. it just really didn't make a lot of sense. If we want to make, changes in the way we allocate our budget dollars, those changes should be based on, smart spending. They should be based on, getting the most value for taxpayers' money. They should be based on, positive outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
Putting money into things that work, putting money into the programs that matter and that help the well-being of the American people.
Mm-hmm.
And the sequestration, deal, I think... obviously I wasn't in the room with these negotiations, but it seemed very much like it was sort of like a deal with the devil, and there was, on the one hand, there was nothing in there for anybody to like. It was that kind of thing, and I think everybody expected that one side or the other would blink, and neither side did. And so, you know, as a country, we've been stuck with that since.
Okay, so President Obama is saying he wants to spend $612 billion on the military. What's our current military budget?
Well, you know, that's a little bit of a fuzzy number, too, because, of course, we're kind of in limbo here with this, you know, Cromnibus year. But needless to say, it's a smaller number. And so what we're looking at is, you know, growing, though, from a place where, you know, it's a smaller number, but it's also a huge number.
So, well, it's 4.5% less than $612 billion, right?
That's right, more or less.
Okay. So that's a big jump. I think any of us would be happy to get a 4.5% raise in our salary here. But help us put that in context, because we all know numbers tend to be big when you're dealing with the federal budget. You know, what share of, you know, first of all, describe to folks, because you're an expert here in this, but usually the federal budget is divided into the discretionary budget that the members of Congress and the president can figure out where to allocate some funds to. And then there's the kind of mandatory budget of the entitlement programs. It's not even entitlement, like Social Security is not an entitlement program per se, but it's a set fixture that the Congress members don't have real control over on a year-to-year basis, right? So tell us, where does this military spending of $612 billion fit in?
All right. So if you take a look at the discretionary. Looking like about 54% of that. So just to sort of think about that, what you're. Allocate. You know, you compare that 54% with, for example, spending 3% on science, spending 4% on international affairs, spending 4% on energy and the environment, and spending, where's education here, 6% on education. So, you know, it's a pretty glaring, you know, comparison of this huge military chunk compared to these other pieces that really should be, you know, so important to both the current well-being but also the future prosperity of this country.
So of the budget that the president and members of Congress can have some say over, the military is getting over half of it. They're getting 54%, right?
That's correct, yep.
So to keep it simple for all of us, you could take every other thing that the federal government spends on that we hear a lot about, the and, you know, the energy, the education, you know, foreign affairs, all of that, all of it together is still less than what they're spending on the military.
That's correct, yep.
Holy Toledo.
Yeah.
And then so we have another frame of reference. What share is it of the total budget?
All right, so as a share of the total budget, you know, because the discretionary piece of the pie is, you know, is actually a smaller piece than the entitlement piece, in terms of total, we're looking at, I think it's 16% for military,
mm-hmm.
You know, and which is, it's still significant for sure.
Yeah, because, you know, you're up against Social Security. All of us who work are paying into that fund. That's why I say it's not really an entitlement program, because we're paying into Social Security, and when we're ready to retire, those funds are available to us to draw down. So, but even when you include that in the picture, you're saying the military is still 16%.
That's right. So, you know, your top three pieces of the total pie would be, you know, the Social Security, unemployment, and labor chunk, which accounts for 33% of the total, Medicare and health, which is 27% of the total, and then military at 16.
So what's the trajectory here? I mean, I know the military budget's been growing because I've been tracking this since the 1970s. And, you know, it was too big then and it keeps growing. But then you really have to look at it within the context of the whole budget. So what's the trend here? Is this kind of fitting the historic pattern or is this different?
Well, you know, you don't.
Okay, it looks like we lost the signal with our guest here, and we're going to loop back in with him to get him back on the line. This is Eleanor LeCain with All Together Now, and our guest today is Dr. Douglas Hall of the National Priorities Project. So just a little more background on Doug is that when he was at the Economic Policy Institute, he did a lot of research on income inequality, economic development, retirement security, labor market analysis, the minimum wage, and paid sick days. So he's well versed in what the economic needs are of the people of America and seems to be concerned about the level of the military spending that then chokes out what could be done in other areas. So I was excited to learn about this group that he worked on, the Economic Analysis and Research Network called EARN, where Doug worked and he grew that network to be 61 mostly state-based organizations representing 44 different states. So they're talking about the impact of federal spending at the state and local level. So, you know, all these things are not abstract. The fact that we're spending this proposed $612 billion in the military, and it's been hundreds of billions for quite a while now, crowds out spending on other things we need. So you might ask, why do we have roads that are in great disrepair? Why do we have bridges falling down like the bridge in Minneapolis? But it's true not just to pick on Minnesota, but it's true all over the country. Our basic roads and bridges need a lot of repair and rebuilding. If you look in Boston, within the past 3 weeks, they just had a series of severe snowstorms with a total of 6 feet of snow landing in Boston and freezing weather, like sub-freezing. And it was so cold and snowy there that they had to shut down the subway system, the MBTA in the greater Boston area. So now you look at some of these, the cars that they have in Boston, those train cars are over 40 years old, some of them. And it's very old technology. It's hard to get it to run well in the best of weather, but in the cold weather, they're just not functioning, as we saw this month. So
that's right, Eleanor. And so I am back now. And
welcome back. So just talking about in Boston, boy, do we need that money in that MBTA to get the trains, you know, new trains, because the new technology in trains can withstand the snow and the cold weather much better than the current technology.
For sure. And so, you know, when you look at something like the president's budget where he's proposing to increase infrastructure spending by about $478 billion over 6 years, you know, that's a direct recognition of the, you know, truly dismal state of our national infrastructure.
Right.
And the need to reinvest there.
Yeah, but, you know, it's hard to reinvest if we're giving all that money into the military. But, you know, what looks like is happening politically is the president's upping the amount for the military, maybe creating some political space so we can up the spending on the domestic, like the roads and bridges and the trail cars. But then that just gets us deeper into debt, doesn't it?
Well, it does, although, you know, having, as you were mentioning, having spent 5 years at the Economic Policy Institute, you know, the message that they've been saying for many years now is that, you know, we actually are still in an environment when you're looking at the overall economy where the federal government decreasing its deficit, decreasing, you know, the impact on debt is actually a harmful thing. You know, we're still in a situation where the labor market, you know, despite some apparently positive numbers, there's still a lot of pain in the pipeline in terms of recovering from that, from the recession that started in 2007.
Definitely. And the other thing to compare to, that's what we were starting to talk about, how does this current spending to compare to historic patterns? We know, you know, really since World War II, there's been big chunks of money going into the military. Obviously, they needed it to win World War II and did a great job there. But then we're kind of in this perpetual war economy. What is the historic pattern here for military spending?
Well, I think I was saying this when I got cut off. You know, if you take a look, you know, at the pattern over time, you know, we're now coming down from sort of a modern era peak, where we were spending, you know, in inflation adjusted dollars, you know, well over $700 billion, I should say. And, you know, the only time, if you look back, you know, to the pre-World War II phase, the only time when we spent more than that, you know, was during World War II. So,
and when did we hit that peak?
You know, it looks like that was probably 1945-ish. You know, and certainly, you know, when you're at war with two countries at once in Iraq and Afghanistan, you know, it's understandable that you're spending money, but that doesn't mean that it doesn't mean that it's a smart way to spend money, and it doesn't mean that you're achieving either your short-term military objectives or your long-term, you know, national security, international relations.
Truly, objectives. I mean, you look at what we spend over $1 trillion for the Iraq War, and does anybody feel safer because of that?
Well, exactly. And, you know, I think that there's actually a fair amount of evidence to suggest that you know, each of those sorts of military endeavors, you know, plants the seeds for future, you know, problems that we'll have to address. You know, it fuels that perpetual endless war cycle that you're referring to.
Absolutely. Look at, you know, here comes ISIS. You know, you know, more terrorist attacks coming. So we have some sense now what we're spending, what the historic pattern is for the U.S. What about how the U.S. military spending compares to other countries? Like if you see China and Russia with huge military budgets, you know, people think, well, no matter what it costs, I want to make sure we keep our country strong. So if, you know, what if China and Russia is certainly the Cold War seems to be, you know, resurging here. The friendly went from very cold to friendly and now back to antagonistic again. So we need to make sure that our spending keeps us safe internationally. How does the U.S. spending compare to other countries?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, because if you take a look at how much we spend on military and stack it up against you know, other industrialized countries that are spending a fair amount of money on military stuff, our spending outpaces, and get ready for this list, outpaces China, Russia, Saudi Arabia, France, the UK, Germany, Japan, India, and South Korea combined.
How many countries did you just list?
I think I listed 9 other countries. I've also seen, you know, something in the last 24 hours suggesting that list might even be a little bit longer. But let's just say for the sake of argument that we're spending, you know, more than the next 9 or 10 countries combined.
Holy Toledo.
Well, that's right. And, you know, I guess what really strikes me is that there's no connection between the money that is being spent and the threat that is, you know, facing our country. You know, either on the secure side, on sort of on our side of the equation, or on the other side of the equation. You know, if you look at those countries that I listed off, you know, really the only one of those countries that in you know, recent years the U.S. has been very concerned about would be South Korea. You know, you don't see Iraq in that mix. You don't see Afghanistan in that mix. Safety and, you know, security as a nation and the military threat that you can sort of place against the world is not a function of how much money you spend in this day and age in particular. You know, and when you look at the sorts of things that have caused the American people to be really stressed about our security in recent years, you know, obviously 9/11 is sort of the epic example of that. You know, that was, you know, a handful of people, you know, with certainly some extensive training over time, no question about that, you know, with box cutters, you know, and then we're worried about, you know, a potential shoe bomber. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, we've got, you know, Charlie Hebdo going on in France, you know, mm-hmm. a few people with guns. And, you know, there's no amount of spending that we could do that would, you know, prevent those things or save us from those things. You know, it's not a function of how much money you're spending. And so we delude ourselves.
It can be a function of how smart you are. But, you know, your point is well taken. I think we kind of got in the practice there with World War II and the Cold War, you know, building up all these very expensive weapon systems, expecting a showdown with the Soviet Union somewhere in the world, mm-hmm. you know, one of the proxy mm-hmm. states, whatever. And it seems like we just keep building these giant weapon systems, and yet, as you're talking about, the nature of the threats has changed dramatically. I mean, our most intense threats are coming from these terrorist acts. Like you talk about, you know, the problem in 9/11 was done with box cutters, mm-hmm. you know, not with a big Russian weapon system. So we need to be thinking smart and thinking strategically about how do we deal with the whole terrorist threat. There's also the threats we get now not coming from nation state at all or even a terrorist. And, you know, the threats from climate change. And I think climate change for a lot of people has kind of been abstract, but now we're looking, we talked about earlier about the 6 feet of snow dumped in eastern Massachusetts yep. and New England in the past few weeks. I mean, that's a serious challenge to the people who live in those areas. You know, people having trouble getting out of their houses, getting their cars out, getting around town, going to work, going to school. It's like everything's come to a stop. It's these once-in-a-lifetime kinds of extreme weather conditions happening with great regularity now. And then we've got, in California, the serious drought that they have. You know, a multi-year drought in California where now the underwater table of California is being drained down, and it's going to take years, if ever, to replenish that water table. So I'm very concerned about those kinds of threats for America. What do you think about that?
Well, I think you're right on the money there. And interestingly, you know, even the Pentagon has quite explicitly acknowledged that climate change is a threat to our national security. You know, mm-hmm. and so as I imagine, you know, a path between, you know, where we are right now in terms of military spending and you know, where I would like to see us go, you know, I'm thinking that a really smart move would be for, you know, some unit of the Pentagon to decide that they're going to take on, you know, making significant inroads fighting climate change, you know, and whether that means shifting more money into, you know, something like the Office of Economic Adjustment, you know, to fuel, you know, the development of smart technology, of green technologies that can help to transform, you know, our state economies. You know, I think there's lots of different ways that could roll out for sure. And, you know, your point about things like drought, you know, obviously that's a real concern. You know, our reliance on hydrocarbon energy sources, you know, is clearly reaping so many harmful effects on the planet. You know, whether it's, you know, through global warming, whether it's through, you know, pipelines that are leaking and polluting, you know, water systems, you know, the list goes on and on. And, you know, not to mention, of course, the fact that, when you look at, you know, many of our more recent sort of military undertakings, they are significantly about protecting sources of oil coming from other parts of the world. Well, clearly, if we were less reliant on oil, we would be less vulnerable to, you know, unrest and unsettled political climates in those countries.
Right, and there's a direct connection there between the climate change and the political unrest. You know, take this thing with the drought in California, for example. You know, there's drought happening in different parts of the world and ongoing. It's actually, you know, I talk to people say it's actually not so much drought anymore as it's a changed weather pattern, and there's going to be a lot less water from now on than there was. You look at the snows of Kilimanjaro in Africa, you know, the snow is disappearing, and same in the Andes Mountains and the Rocky Mountains. The ever-white snow-capped peaks are now not ever-white because they're not getting the snow they used to, which means then the water is not coming down. And then if you talk about people not having water, I mean, you could live for a while without food, but, you know, you absolutely have to have water. But that change in climate is going to affect access to water, the ability to drink water, the ability to grow food, and that's, you could see all kinds of political unrest springing from that. But you're pointing out that the Pentagon sees the climate change as a threat, rightly so, and it could be that they become an unlikely ally to help deal with climate change, do you think?
Well, I think there's definitely that possibility, and, you know, if I was being completely honest, I would say that, you know, that seems like, you know, one of the more hopeful paths that we might see.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that's partly reflecting the fact that, you know, there's so much inertia around, you know, the spending that the Pentagon, the Department of Defense, are undertaking. You know, you're talking about, you know, a government agency that has contracts that extend, you know, 5, 7, 10 years into the future. You know, they've already committed to spending money way down the road.
Mm-hmm.
And there, you know, are significant corporate interests that stand to benefit from that. And those corporate interests have extensive batteries of lobbyists, of, you know, all of those folks that help to keep, you know, that military-industrial congressional complex churning. And, you know, if one can imagine a situation where, you know, suddenly those, you know, let's say top five military contractors, what if they were instead becoming the leading corporate interests around green technologies? You know, their bottom lines would be at least as happy, if not more so. Their lobbyists would, you know, still be pushing to advance the interests of those corporations, but they could be pursuing interests that are complementary to, rather than antithetical to, the interests of our nation, of our planet, etc.
Yeah, that's an exciting idea, and you're actually answering the question I was about to ask you, is why does the United States spend so much on the military as compared to other countries, and you answered it there. You know, it's the corporate interest, the lobbyists, but you're absolutely right. You know, they could still make a lot of money and be the leaders in green technology, and there is some of that happening. You know, the armed forces are doing some work with solar, in part because they understand the inevitability that we're going to run out of oil, or that with some kind of a war, you know, or the cold relations with Russia or other countries, that we could have significant amounts of our oil supplies cut off overnight.
Mm-hmm.
So the armed forces, I think, have been in the forefront of developing and implementing some of the green technology. So if we can kind of go more down that path, I think that would be kind of a good use of our tax dollars. I'm reminded back in 1984, I was involved with the Peace and Environmental Coalition, and we put together a program that we wanted both parties to follow. And we ended up with over 100 organizations with over 10 million members backing this program. And it basically, one of the main platforms was to call for a shift from the global arms race to the global environmental recovery race.
That's
what we need to do. We need to shift it from who can make more of these weapons to kill each other off, and shift the competition to be who can help restore the earth, you know, fastest and best.
Right, right. And there's no question that those are the sorts of conversations we need to be having.
Yeah, we could dust that off, but we haven't made much progress. That's what makes me a little concerned. Now you're talking, that's 30 years ago. That idea hasn't had a lot of traction yet. So what gives you hope that that might change?
Well, you know, I think that sometimes desperate situations, you know, mm-hmm. cause people to see things with a slightly different perspective. And, you know, I think implicit in your question is a fear that we may find ourselves, you know, far enough down a road that, even changing our ways won't have as much of an impact as we need it to. And, you know, that's certainly a frustration. And, you know, all of the questions around climate change, you know, it's really quite striking to me that, our elected officials have not done a better job of making sure that those concerns, you know, are, forefront in the thinking of our country, because certainly, you know, if the question is you know, who's the strongest country on a planet that is doomed, you know, that's not a very positive outlook, right?
Right, you'd be the strongest person dying on the planet.
Exactly.
Well, I think you're right. I think, you know, you just look at us as individuals. You know, when do people become more open to change? It's when, you know, they're given a diagnosis of a terminal illness. You know, you've got cancer. You've got 1 year to live. You know, unless you take action, make some changes, whatever it is, lose some weight, eat better food, exercise. And it's in those times when things can open up, and I actually think we're kind of at that point now, and more people are becoming aware of it, that we absolutely have to address this climate change issue, or that, you know, it'll be like a couple of guys wrestling on a railroad track with the train coming down. It doesn't matter if you win the wrestling match, the train's going to clobber you, and the train in this instance is the global climate change, where people won't be able to breathe on the planet.
Yeah. You know, and when you overlay on top of that the fact that we have, you know, people who are climate change deniers in you know, significant positions of power on, in relevant congressional committees, that's obviously not a positive, you know, dimension to this either.
Right. And do you happen to know, someone told me that there are two lobbyists for every member of Congress that lobby on behalf of the defense industry. Do you know if that's true?
I wouldn't want to say for sure that that's true, but it certainly sounds very believable.
Yeah. And what are some of the other elements with the president's budget that, you know, look like they're outside of the military budget, but they're actually linked to Pentagon spending?
Well, you know, the interesting thing, of course, about, you know, public budgeting is that really everything's connected to each other, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're talking about, you know, a situation where, you know, you've got a relatively finite, you know, amount of resources, you know, every dollar you spend on the military is a dollar that you don't have to spend on other things. And I just want to quickly read a quote from Dwight Eisenhower, and certainly he's somebody who, you know, everybody knows about his military-industrial complex quote, but this one's good, and you may have heard it as well. And he says, every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed. This world in arms is not a spreading is not spending money alone. It is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hopes of its children. You know, and that's powerful, for sure, and, you know, no less relevant, you know, 50 years later.
Right. I love that quote. That's one of my favorite quotes. And I love even more that it comes from a Republican president who was, you know, our best general in World War II.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so, you know, he could say things that maybe a more liberal president couldn't really get away with. But that is so absolutely right. You know, there is still the mentality among a lot of people that we need to spend a lot of money to keep our country safe. What would you say to them?
Well, again, this sort of harkens back to the conversation we had about sort of the nature of the threats we're facing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that we are concerned about safety is entirely appropriate because there's no question that there are some threats out there. But I also think that we need to figure out what the sort of military and sort of national security equivalent of, you know, the doctor's admonition that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And there's no question that, you know, some of the challenges that we face are fueled by, you know, we're the ones that are planting seeds by, you know, by supporting insurgents in one country or another, you know, to help us out in this conflict or that conflict, only to have those same insurgents turn on us, you know, or to turn on allies of ours at some future point in time. Obviously, that's not, you know, money well spent. You know, the gross imbalance between what we're spending on military endeavors versus what we're spending on you know, diplomacy, you know, through the Department of State, for example. You know, and I'm certainly not suggesting that there should be parity there, but, you know, we need, instead of cutting back the number of diplomats that are out there in the world having, you know, high-level communications with other foreign leaders, you know, we should be looking for ways to better understand each other, you know, to be in constant and productive dialogue with the leaders of other nations of the world. And to do what we can to, you know, turn back the clock on some of those, you know, the political, the climate things that are causing unrest, you know, rather than being so clearly one of the nations that's fueling those sorts of things.
Right. That's good. I like that. You know, I'm from New England. We love those maxims like an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think that's so true when it comes to our nation's security. Say some more about how you think that. I like your idea, more money for diplomacy. If we put more money into diplomacy and increasing cross-cultural understanding, we could probably save a lot of money on these weapon systems, don't you think?
We certainly could, and, you know, certainly not insignificantly. While we were saving ourselves money, we would also be saving, you know, lives. You know, I read an article the other day that was basically saying, you know, war is just terrorism with a bigger budget. And, you know, if you look at the things that we've been doing, you know, sending drones in, you know, with collateral damage, with, you know, citizens, you know, dying because of our military actions, you know, and if somebody else did that to us, you know, we wouldn't stand for it. But, you know, we somehow tell ourselves that that's acceptable. And, you know, I'm not sure that endears us to the rest of the world either. You know, and then there's other sort of pieces of the puzzle that are ongoing as well. So, for example, you know, right now we have a budget in place for this fiscal year for everybody except the Department of Homeland Security. Now, you would think that in these tenuous times, the security of our nation would be, you know, something that would be first and foremost. But apparently we're in an environment where, you know, threatening to unfund the Department of Homeland Security is an appropriate response to disagreeing with the president's immigration policies. You know, so there's a lot of rhetoric and talk,
mm-hmm.
You know, about security, about being, you know, presenting a strong face to the world. But we're often following that up with decisions that take us, in fact, in the absolute wrong direction, if not, in fact, the opposite direction.
Right, which I think is what happened with the war in Iraq. You know, first of all, Saddam Hussein in Iraq had nothing to do with the attacks in New York City and elsewhere in 9/11. You know, most of those people came from Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't have any war with, I think it was 19 out of those 21 terrorists involved at 9/11 were from Saudi Arabia. But they have too much oil. We didn't, and too close a relations with them. And just instead said, okay, well, we're going after Iraq. So right off the bat, you know, the foundations there were very shaky for why we attacked. But having done that attack, it's just sown a lot of seeds of hostility and anger, as you were talking about, when we send drones and weapons down there and it kills women and children and families, it doesn't win us any friends.
I think that's a safe bet.
Yeah. So we know we're overspending. We know we're spending on the wrong things in large measure. How much money do you think we could cut from the military budget without harming our real security?
Well, again, I think that depends a lot on what the perceived threats actually are that you're trying to respond to. You know, certainly the Pentagon itself has, you know, identified, you know, some aspects of even its own bureaucracy that could be pared back in a way that could save us, you know, tens of billions of dollars. If you take a look at some of the weapon systems that we're pursuing, you know, the F-35 fighter that we've already poured so much money into, you know, even in the president's budget, he's proposing increasing the number of F-35 fighters by 57. Now, this is an aircraft that has been, you know, literally in production for, you know, for many, many years, and, you know, the tab is running, but we're actually getting further away from, rather than closer to, having a fighter aircraft that has cutting-edge technology. Instead, we're getting further and further away. We, you know, it's basically, by the time it comes off the production line, you know, in a fully functional way, it's going to have, you know, decade-old technology in it. But will have cost, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars. That just doesn't make sense. And I think that we're too reluctant to sort of stop at that process of spending, you know, throwing good money after bad. And that's clearly not productive. But it's also reflective of, you know, this relationship with, you know, with the big military contractors. You know, it would be unthinkable, sort of from the perspective of that thinking, you know, to simply say, guess what, we're canceling those.
Yeah. Well, the idea about having smart spending and saving dollars on the military had a big champion in Representative Barney Frank in the U.S. House from Massachusetts, but he retired and he's no longer in office. But I know when he left office, he said one of the main things he wanted to keep active on was to make the case for cutting the military spending. Mm-hmm. Are you in touch with Representative Barney Frank at all, and what is he proposing that our budget should be?
Well, I haven't been in touch with him lately, but I know that he's been a real champion for, you know, exactly what you're talking about. We actually run a program with Peace Action, so it's National Priorities Project and Peace Action, and it's called Move the Money, and it's all about empowering, you know, local advocates to, you know, to learn about what's going on in defense spending and to, you know, to both equip themselves in terms of their knowledge, but also, you know, to really give them the tools so that they can advocate for shifting money out of the Pentagon into, you know, the sorts of programs that people rely on.
Yeah, well, let's talk a little bit about the National Priorities Project. What's your mission, and why did you start? Why was the organization started?
So we've been around now for about 32 years. And, you know, we were formed really out of that realization that human needs were not being met at the same time that we were spending, you know, billions of dollars on warfare. And so sort of the really one most constant piece of our organizational DNA is that sort of recognition that our national priorities need to reflect, the well-being of the people. They need to also reflect, I think, the will of the people to a certain extent. I mean, certainly, there's so many, spending decisions that are out of sync with the expressed desires of the American people. And you see that, there's a great many manifestations of that. But our belief at the National Priorities Project is that by empowering people to understand the federal budget, both the process and the outcomes of that process, we equip them to be more engaged in the political process, to be more active, citizens, and to, do their part to revitalize American democracy. And, certainly there are a great many indicators to suggest that our democracy is in a really bad way. And, whether you're talking there about the influence of big money spending, especially that was sort of unleashed through Citizens United, whether you're talking about the efforts to prevent people from voting, there's lots of really nasty manifestations of the malaise that is facing our democracy. But certainly having the people take back their budget, that would be a big step in the right direction, and that's really what we're looking to do and to facilitate at the National Priorities Project.
Yeah, that's great. And for our listeners, I encourage you to check out nationalpriorities.org, the website for the National Priorities Project. There's some really good information there about how the federal budget works and who decides the federal budget. If you could just, I know it's a complex process, but how can we, the people, influence the decision on the military budget? Who's making the decisions? Where can we intervene to make a difference, to redirect some of those funds to the real security of building our roads and bridges and dealing with the climate change challenge?
Yeah, well, those are very good questions, and certainly, as citizens, our best chance of influencing the process is by being in touch in a meaningful way with our congressional representatives. So if you don't know who your congressman is, your congresswoman, if you don't know who your senators are, you need to find that out, and you need to make sure that you've got them on your speed dial. And I think it's important that they know not just the things that you want them to spend money on, but also the things you don't want them to spend money on. Recognizing that for each of us, there's going to be sort of a different basket, and, probably no one's going to be completely happy at the end of the day. But certainly if one imagines, you asked a little bit about the president's proposed budget and, some of the things in there that could be just so transformative for our country, like the proposal to provide, free college tuition, for example, and the president's preschool for all proposal. Those are things that, would so obviously, move the education of our citizenry in the right direction while preventing an entire generation from, facing a lifetime of crushing debt. Those are good things that make our country stronger today and make our economy better, throughout the future. And for people to understand that those are the trade-offs that they're looking at. Every dollar, it's back to the Eisenhower quote, right? And giving people a sense that they can influence, how that plays out. And there's lots of, course, different ways to be engaged in the political process and to make your influence as an individual be felt. Certainly, up against, the huge spending capacity of corporate interests, we as citizens should also be doing what we can to support the candidates that agree with our perspectives.
That's exactly right, you make good points there. But when I look at things like in Kansas City where the schools are shutting down because the city doesn't have enough money to run the schools, and the need for the libraries, the need, as you point out, for our kids now, the next generation is $1 trillion in debt with the student debt. to go to a community college or a four-year college, and what a burden we're putting on the next generation, and there's no option of them declaring bankruptcy and getting a fresh start because the banks made sure that there was no option for that, for the student loan. So all of those things, you know, every time I look at those, I go, well, if we want to address that issue, here's our 54% of the discretionary budget is going into the military. How about if we redirect some of that to keep the schools open in Kansas City and to make sure our young people get the college education, whether it's a community college or a four-year college?
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's just so many much better ways. But I often, it's missing in the debate. People just kind of seem to think America is going downhill and that we don't have the money. And it's just so not true. We have lots of money. Americans never been richer.
That's right. And the point that you make is so important. And I'd just really like to weigh in on the Kansas situation because, you know, that didn't happen by accident. That happened, that was intentionally brought on the state by a governor who promised to, you know, to reduce taxes. He was going to transform the economy by, you know, giving people back some of their tax dollars, you know, and completely ignoring the fact that, you know, we as citizens, you know, what should be fueling our budget decisions is the answer to the question, what kind of country do we want?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what do we want our state to look like? What do we want our communities to look like? And then you ask the question, and how can we pay for it?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it at some point, there's certainly some of that sort of everybody wants to go to heaven, but nobody wants to die kind of thing. You know, I get that if people were choosing between, you know, paying more in taxes or keeping the money themselves to spend, you know, obviously a lot of people, you know, default to, I want to keep my money. But do you want to keep your money and then drive on roads that that cost you more money? You know, one of the things I would love to see, I'd love to see data on the rising rate of people spending money on replacing their tie rods in their cars, mm-hmm. as we all hit all of the potholes that didn't get fixed because we cut back our budgets, you know, our local budgets, our state budgets, et cetera. You know, people don't, I feel like there's a reluctance to sort of to see the value that we're getting for our public investments. You know, whether that's the fact that we still can, in fact, breathe the air, which, you know, that might be time limited if we keep going down this, mm-hmm. You know, carbohydrate burning road. You know, when we buy food, there's a fairly high level of certainty that food will be safe because our governments, you know, inspect and regulate that. You know, when we swim in a lake, there's a fairly high level of certainty that that lake will be clean and that we're not going to, you know, get some awful disease from that. And, you know, those are the outcomes of the ways that we have collectively spent our public dollars. And, you know, it takes money to do that. Now, having said that, there's also lots of evidence that there are, you know, the very wealthy in this country, that corporations in this country are not paying their fair share. And so, you know, enacting policies, you know, tax policies that you know, dial that back a little bit, you know, would certainly move us in the right direction.
Yeah. That sounds like the right direction. I am concerned with the Republicans controlling both the House and the Senate now about it going in the wrong direction, and they're actively pushing for even more defense spending than the president is suggesting. And I find it ironic that some of the, actually a cruel irony, that some of the people who yell the loudest about wanting to cut government spending are the very same people who refuse to reduce the massive amount of money we spend on the military and who refuse to cut the subsidies to the super rich oil companies or the very wealthy individuals. So, but you know, that's kind of where we're at. But I think you're right. You know, we have concern about the control and the influence of the military corporations. But the reason they're powerful is that they have money and the politicians want the money. But the reason politicians want the money is to get the votes. And what we, the people, have is we are the votes. And we have a lot more votes than the corporations have money. So if we get informed and educated and active around this issue, then we're going to win this hands down. So I appreciate what you're doing at the National Priorities Project to educate people about the military budget. And also you do a lot of work on what's happening in the states, right? Yep, we seem to have lost our guests. Well, we're coming to the end of our program here. I want to thank our guests for being with us today. And that's Douglas Hall, the Executive Director of the National Priorities Project. And, yeah, thank you for coming on the program. In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you want to learn more about Breakthrough Solutions, go to thebreakthroughway.com. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. Many thanks to our research associate, Dr. Judith Singleton. I'll be back next week. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor LeCain with All Together Now.